Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com from coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.10Live.
Boys Lip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Camas Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Hello, the Burgesses.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery.
Tommy Bird Ridge Winery.
Toy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauer Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vivac Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWinemaker.com. I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Belvoir Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiast and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Happy because we're inside. We're getting some rains here in Florida. Rains here in the Tampa Bay area. Expected a lot more, but not as much as they predicted has came in. Well, at least not here. It's raining around us in Tampa and north of us and all that, but not on top of us. So that's always a good thing. If you're listening to the program at 7:03 Eastern Time on September the 17th, 2015, then you're live and you can call me 646-727-3235 and we can chat, keep it about wine, and we'll bring you on the air and I'll talk to you for a little bit. Mike is still not with us. It's becoming a habit here. He's got himself a job that's scheduling him on Thursday evenings and he's tied up with that. So we are plodding along by ourselves again. For all of you Mike fans out there, sorry, he will be back, though. The last time I chatted with him, he was looking forward to getting on a different schedule and coming back and joining us. So, and I miss him, too, because he always is a good person in the background to keep me informed about some of the stuff I'm trying to look up and all that, which I don't have time to do. I just saw a new thing on my dashboard here on my switchboard, rather, that I didn't know was there. So, you got me again on this. We got some more information tonight, more stuff to pass on to you, more things to talk about. Again, all about wine, different things that have happened and is happening in the wine industry and about the wine industry and things associated with the wine industry. So we'll start out with, we'll jump right into it and see what we can find to talk about it. Oh, I know what I was going to tell you too. Last week we were talking about wine being served at a ballpark and A couple of them were mentioned. I think Baltimore does it and all that. And I said, I'm going to check into that and see how many ballparks serve wine and what they serve. And, you know, oh, my gosh, I can't believe how hard it is to find out that information. I thought it would just be a simple matter of maybe going to one spot or just punching in wine served at ballparks or something. But it's really not that available. So when I find out all the ballparks and I'll get it down, I will let you know. You know, it might be worth checking on, too, since this is getting into second week of football season and hockey season. They're reporting now this week all the hockey players are back on the ice and getting ready for the new season. We'll check on that and see if there's wine served at any sports venues around this country or any sport. So I'll check onto that and let you know at a future date, obviously, because I haven't found anything else yet on this. Let's see. Let's go to this and see what we've got here to tell you. Here we go. That's what I wanted. Radical weather in Texas. We all keep talking about how the weather's affecting California and stuff like that, but the weather situation in this country is really, really strange. Everybody, wherever they are, I'm sure, is experiencing their strange weathers and all sorts of different things that are going on and happening and all that. And it's affecting everything, not just wine grapes, but a lot of stuff. And people in Texas are used to crazy weathers in the spring and summer. You're not going to find any winemakers that are really whining about it. They said that they're very blessed. Marnell Durrett, who is the winemaker and proprietor of Kuypersal Vineyards and Winery in Texas, said he's finishing up its harvesting for the year. And he said it looks good. They're really high-quality grapes. Marnell is a female, I'm sorry. She thinks the weather is the reason for that. In May, it was a record rainfall, and it set up for some great ripening. The hot summer really came in with some dryness, no rain, sunshine every day, and the grapes ripened very well. Said that the rains they saw just last week were important because the soil was getting a little bit dried out, and it is looking good. They didn't have to irrigate. They didn't have to worry about feeding livestock or anything, and the vines, as vines rest up for 2016, they said that they're looking for another great harvest. And also, they got a good harvest on the squash, squash juice, and all that other things that they're growing there. They said they're putting the wines through a second fermentation process, and they said now it's a waiting game for several weeks to see what's going to happen. Then now they become sort of like a glorified babysitter waiting to see if it's going to lay down to rest and take care of itself while it's going through everything. The Texas wine industry, as young as it might be, is really making a name for itself. As we talked to them a few months ago, and noted that they were named the Hill Country of Texas was named one of the 10 best wine regions in the world by Wine Enthusiast magazine. So a big thing for them there. But the Texas wine's looking good. They are coming in nicely. Most of them has been picked at this time, and they're going into the fermentation, so that's looking good for Texas wines right there. Another thing, while we're talking about Texas wine, the Santa Rita Hills AVA, I don't know if I mentioned this or not. I may have talked about the Santa Rita Hills. This isn't in Texas. I was thinking about Hill Country when I said that. Santa Rita Hills is just named a new AVA. The first vineyard in Santa Rita Hills was planted in 1971, and it went by the name of Sanford and Benedict. In 1997, the petition was submitted for the growers in that area, and it official status was fully granted in 2001. The mountain valley tends to lead to east-west wind corridor, and the temperatures usually never rise above 80 degrees. Santa Rita Hills, by the way, is up in the northern part of California. I think it's south of Sonoma. Let me see if I can find it here. I'm not... Central Coast. Oh, Central Coast. Oh, wow. My bad. I was thinking up in Sonoma, but it's Central Coast. A total of 59 vineyards covered 2,700 acres with 20 different grape varietals. Almost 95% of it, though, is dedicated to the Pinot Noir because of the cool temperatures that are coming off. It's the region's signature grape. Around 2,100 acres are dedicated to Pinot Noir, with about 500 to Chardonnay, and the remaining small acreage to Syrah, Sauvignon Blanc, Grenache, and 15 or so other varietals. It has very diverse soil, and this makes for a nice, well-drained area. And there's what they call Monterey Shell that helps with the drainage, and which also helps to give the Pinot Noir its black cherry cola complexity, as they call it. A very spicy Pinot Noir. The Foley Estate is the largest landholder in the Santa Rita Hills. They also have quite a few other wineries there. The Foley Estates grows grapes for Lincourt Vineyards, Foley Estates, and Two Sisters. The primary grapes of Santa Rita Hills, again, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, with Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Syrah, Grüner Veltliner, and Pinot Blanc, all from the Foley Estates. Higher elevation in that area too, with good drainage and stuff. Just a very unique little area, a unique AVA there. They're saying that Santa Rita Hills is still a small wine region with rooms to grow. Still sort of a secret find. When people come meet the owners and winemakers and everything there, they get almost a homey atmosphere. A few of the vineyards that were planted a couple years ago are starting to attract smaller wineries looking to contract fruit. And in general, it's good for the area, they're saying, but make it harder for smaller wineries to really make a go of it because it's such a concentrated and unique little area there. So, Santa Rita Hills, it's AVA. If you happen to see that out there anywhere, then you might pick up a bottle of it. Something unique and coming of its own in the area of California, Central California. And let's see, let's move on to the next article I want to share. And that is, oh, here we go. Researchers have developed a method to sniff out counterfeit wine without opening the bottle. Now that's interesting. That's why I'm going to share it with you. No, I don't want to see that. Let's continue on to the article. Looking for authentic wine without opening the bottle. How do you know wine's authentic without opening the bottle? A team of researchers at UC Irvine believe they developed a valuable tool that tests the authenticity of wine by extracting wine vapor molecules from the cork while it's still in the bottle. We say. Fraud and scandal in the wine business is nothing new. It's been exploding, actually, in recent years, is guys sitting in jail for doing a lot of it. We've talked about that about a year ago. Rare collectible wines are increasingly becoming a global product, and because it's global in wines, it's causing the problem to explode. Not sure how big the problem is, but a report by the International Chamber of Commerce projected that more than 1.77 trillion, and that's with a T, people, $1.77 trillion worth of counterfeit goods will be traded worldwide this year. For wine that ranges from cunning fakes of old Bordeaux bottles to cheap knockoffs of Australian Syrahs. And so $1.77 trillion of counterfeit, which there's a chunk of that that's being traded in wines. The wine fraud detection measures now are not real good. Several tests to determine the vintage of the bottle requires opening the bottle. So if you buy yourself an old wine and you want to find out if it's a fake, you got to open it. Well, that's not a good thing. Other methods are inexact, require having an authentic sample of the wine on hand to compare the results. So you can have two wines, but, you know, I mean, if you're going to go out and spend lots of money for one, you're not going to have much of an opportunity to have a second one there to check and see if it's good or bad. So, wow. Most wine authenticators still work by taking a long look at bottles, labels, corks, and capsules for telltale signs of forgery, which keeps them from having to pop open that bottle just to tell you if it's good or bad. But a Dr. Simon Farney and a Dr. Benjamin Fuller, researchers at UC Irvine's Earth System Science Department, also are wine drinkers. And discussing the counterfeiting problem, they began brainstorming a new test. And they also asked Dr. John Southen, the director of the university's radiocarbon dating laboratory, for some help. They said that Simon, Dr. Farney, and Dr. Fuller set about designing and conducting the necessary experiments in their free time and on weekends. This was a fun what-if project, they said, not part of the regular routine of research experiments. And they had no idea what they were going to find. They had no idea if it was going to be successful or not, but it was something that they just played with just for giggles. So, according to the recently published study in analytical chemistry, the three men did succeed. They created a non-invasive procedure that uses vacuum suction to date a wine by its angel's share. By its angel's share. Now, I'm confused on that. What's angel's share? I guess that's Ulich. That's Ulich, you know, by its angel's share. Is so it evaporates out, you know, from the drink. Oh, here we go. Due to the natural permeability of the bark of a cork tree, the ulage, the small headspace between the wine surface and the cork, grows over time as alcohol and water particles escape as vapors, a loss often called the angel's share. Well, there you go. I've never heard of that term. My engineer just told me in the background she has. Good for her. Yeah. That's why we keep her around, for filling me in on stuff like that. So, a new vintage verification method uses a vacuum to extract gas and liquid vapors, part of the angel's share that has evaporated and is passing through the cork. Yeah, you know, I have to make a comment here. I say passing through the cork. Many, many, many years ago, I was told that that stuff does pass through the cork. That's why you use corks, because it lets stuff pass through it. About 12 and a half, 13 years ago, I was told that that's not true. It doesn't. And I was told that's not true by a couple of people that I respected very highly. And I wanted to believe them, but yet I had trouble believing them because I'd always heard something else. And since then, I've read so many things otherwise. And so, just, yeah, it's Just because people tell you doesn't always make it true. So, just like on the internet, if it's on the internet, it has to be true. I had a young lady come into the winery and say, everything on the internet has to be approved by the president. So if you read on the internet, it's been approved by the president, and therefore it has to be true. And I looked at her thinking, really? Yeah, okay. Back to this. The vacuum is applied only to the top of the cork, leaving the majority of the closure and bottle unaffected. After the extraction, the cork can then be bled up with inert argon gas, protecting the cork and wine from air intrusion. So there you go. It protects it even further. The extracted gas is analyzed to measure atoms of carbon-14. And that's your radioactive isotope. We've all heard of carbon-14 dating. Atmospheric levels of carbon-14 have varied in the last 60 years as a result of above-ground nuclear explosive testing. I didn't know that. Each carbon-14 atom is minute compared to the other particles in the sample size. So Fuller compared it to searching for one drop of water in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. We're looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack, he said. Jeez. After testing 32 wines loaned by a kind wine collector, and if the wine collector was probably told they were testing to see if they were fake, he was more than kind. He probably got them all tested for free. Fuller's father, who is the wine collector, and the team was able to accurately date 23 of the 32, or 72%. They are working on a portable device, potentially allowing investigators to sample bottles in cellars before analyzing results in the lab. Too cool. 100% accuracy remains out of reach. They say some natural corks retain less permeability than others, and that limits the sample size. And carbon contamination and corked wines will always cause a problem or a degree of unpredictability. The team next plans to test wines that are known to be fraudulent to check the method's reliability. And well, you would think that they would do that right away before they start saying they found this. They also believe there are opportunities in measuring other chemicals to possibly sniff out flawed wines. You know, that could get awful expensive, though, if you ask me. While a wine might be authentic, is it worth buying if it is spoiled or peaked or turned? So they hope to have what began as a fun project could someday restore wine consumers' confidence. So that's cool. That's a neat thing to do there, and that's a good idea. If I'm going to go out and spend lots of money on some wines that I'm going to sell and put away, and that's been around, that would be nice to know that they're good and I'm getting a good product. Places like these great big wine cellars all around the country that offer wines and all, some of their wines would probably benefit from being tested before they lay them down, open them, lay them on the table for people and all that. So sounds like a great new idea, and if we see more on it, we will pass that on to you. But a new method to search out counterfeit wines. And Southern Arizona winemakers looking forward to their 2015 harvest, which has just started, actually, by the way. Okay, let's click out of that. Let's go down. Excuse me. Catch my throat right there. And let's go down to this. And there is heat and drought in French wines that are causing a problem. Where are we? What is this? No. Uh, there it is. Heat and drought reduced French wine harvest. We've talked about the weather around the world, how it's really affected everything and how it's really causing fits and problems in so many places. France has had their share of problems this year also. The heat and the drought has reduced the French wine harvest. So officials have estimated that the 2015 wine harvest is going to be a smaller crop than last year. And they are saying that the world's leading producer of wine, after two difficult years marked by rain and cold temperature, has led way to this season's heat wave and drought, which has limited the yield. It's about 1 million hectoliters lower than last year. They're saying it can't fall any further, or else they won't be able to maintain their competitiveness in the world. The fall production has consequences, including a rise in the cost of production, and it's also precocious vintage. Since 1950, this is the earliest harvest for those of 2003 and 2006. And in spite of the small fall in the total volume, they expect the quality to be right up there. It is a rather good vintage, they're saying. The wine, our vines like to suffer a little, and I've mentioned that before, that if the vines suffer a little, it puts a little bit more juice, sweetness into the grapes, which results in a better wine. The heat and dryness have revived talks all over France of climate change and what it's going to do to the varieties there in the wine regions of France. Renewed the talks, which, it should, because they are in a precarious spot there. Here's something that I just saw that was interesting, too. Plans for Carignan appellation in Chile. Carignan is a good grape. I like Carignan. Mark, who I worked with for a long time, was a big fan of Carignan. Why did that jump back? I had it on here, and then it jumped back to something else. That's irritating. There we go. Carignan, Carignan. Carignan. Carmenere might be considered Chile's signature grape, but the country really is becoming more and more increasingly associated with the Carignan. I hadn't heard that. If they have, that's something new to me. The country's first appellation of denomination has been proposed by two Chilean universities based on dry farm Carignan. In January, the University of Talca, which is in the capital of Mali region, inaugurated a research program into Carignan with the stated aim to build the arguments needed to become the nation's first DOCAOC. And having Carignan be the grape. The university's Grape and Wine Technology Center is working with Mali, I think it's pronounced M-A-U-L-E, Mali government, and a group of Carignan producers on the Carignan de Mali Terroir Project. The project will observe Carignan vines covering 400 hectares, belonging to 100 different growers, collecting data on the vines, climate, soil, and all that good stuff. This will allow researchers to build a complex map of the region, showing the terroir and the microclimates and the dry-growing Carignan, be able to identify typical flavor compounds. The University of Chile at Santiago is also carrying on extensive research into the Mali dry farm Carignan. Wow. I have never looked for Chilean Carignan. I've always looked for Chilean Carmenere. It's really interesting. Vinadores de Carignan, or Vigno, is a group of Carignan producers which have already banded together to preserve and celebrate old vine Carignan, whose vineyard was devastated in the Mali region in 2010 earthquake. The new group was founded in 2011, and there are now 15 wineries producing vignal wines from small estates to producers such as Concha de Toro and Miguel Torres and Undaruga. They say to qualify as a vignal product, a wine must contain 65% of Carignan, with a balance of balance made up of old vine varieties. So there you go, Carignan. If you're looking for Chilean wines, they make some great stuff all the way around, I think. But I always look for Carmenere. I guess it's going to have to change and start looking for Carignan and see what I can find on that too. That's interesting little bit of information there. Lower alcohol. That, for a while, California's been coming out with some real high alcoholic wines. I mean, like 16.5%, even 17.5% alcohol wines. And we refer to high alcohol wines as hot. And they were just so overpowering, so alcoholic that it became almost unpleasant. You started to lose the flavors of what you were looking for in the wine because of the alcohol. Well, many California vintners reduce their alcohol in their wines, but very few admit it, and very few boast about it. But Randy Dunn of Dunn Vineyards is saying he likes his Cabernets to have a ripe fruit flavors, but he doesn't want it to be over 14% alcohol. So he uses the technology of reverse osmosis to get the alcohol down to 13.9%. He says restrained alcohol and high-end calves have made him a hero to many of the wine lovers, though it cost him 4 years of reviews from the Wine Advocate, which ended up hurting him in his business, he said. His son, Mike Dunn, hates alcohol reduction. When Mike takes over the winery on Howell Mountain, he says that's one thing he'll change. You know, I don't want to spend my weekend de-alking, Mike says. I like to stop, and I don't want to make 15% alcohol calves either. I'm firmly in the low alcohol camp. I just don't want to manipulate it. It goes on here and talks about the pair and the dad and son and their argument about what they're doing in the alcohol. Mike is 49 and does most of the day-to-day work at the winery, whereas Randy's dad is sort of semi-retired, but not really. He's there and putting his hands in everything all the time. They're saying that other wineries actually do lower their alcohol in it. They've found that a little bit lower alcohol is much more attractive to people. The Dunn Vineyard Cab comes in at 14.2% alcohol, they don't think they're not going to take it any higher than that. So a reduction of alcohol in wine is an interesting concept that, I don't know, most of the time you don't have to do that, but if you start to go crazy on your fermentation and stuff, it can get really, really high alcohol. So lower alcohol wines is something that really is being done, but not that you know of, basically, is what they're saying. All right, let's see. Oh, yeah, here's something that was interesting, too. Where are we? 31st, that's it. We've mentioned this in the past, and we've talked about this a little bit, and I've mentioned some articles to you about it. But here's something else again, and where is it? Here we go. This is, well, come up here. There we go. talked about the casino in Finger Lakes area. We've mentioned that a couple, three times about, you know, what they're going to do and what it would do and how it would affect the traffic and all this other stuff. But they're saying now, this newest article here, is saying that this will be a good thing for the Finger Lakes area. He said the beautiful town of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, has a series of links and is ready for the anchor. It's somewhat of an anomaly for the current generation. This guy says, while all of his friends moved south to the city, he was fortunate to continue living and stay in New York. And the Lego Resort and Casino will be the anchor in the Northern Finger Lakes that will hold people in the area and actually bring people into the area. It's a rarity that people are actually stay in the areas that they are in the Finger Lakes. Most of them move out and go to other areas, but the progress that other states have made over New York in bringing people in and keeping them in is definitely much more so than in New York. So they think that the city of Tyre can benefit and profit tremendously from having a casino in it, which is right basically in the heart of the Finger Lakes areas. A couple of extra $1,000 saving on taxes and different things and opening up some other tourist spots there, as a casino will bring in more things besides just the gambling, but it also gives you more of an opportunity to open up other hotels and food spots and all that. So they're saying keep up hope and raise a glass of local wine to the Lego Resort and Casino, which is being battled still, even as we speak, for the town of Tyre in the Finger Lakes. So who knows? Who knows what's going to happen there? I think it's going to end up getting one there. We'll see. And this was something I found that was very funny, and I have to share with you too. This is, come on now, pull it up. I was going to just segue right into this, but then the thing decided to take a little bit. This is an EasyJet plane makes emergency landing after damage caused by a champagne cork. An EasyJet plane was forced to make an emergency landing. Cork smashed ceiling panels after a stewardess opened the bottle for a customer. It caused the oxygen mask to drop from the ceiling. The plane was halfway through a four-hour flight from London Gatwick to Dalaman, Turkey. The pilot was forced to make an emergency landing in Italy for repairs. One passenger said, it wasn't very funny at the time, but I can see the lighter side now. A man was tasered on EasyJet plane at Gatwick after a row over two pieces of hand luggage. EasyJet puts an end to guaranteed cabin baggage policy. This is all that hassle, delay, and money wasted by EasyJet all over a champagne cork. No one on the flight could believe it, and people I have spoken to have found it hilarious. The flight, which took off at 4:20 p.m. on August the 7th, was diverted to Milan so the mask could be reset. An EasyJet spokesman said they can confirm that flight EZY8845 from London Gatwick to Dalaman on 7 August diverted to Milan Malpensa as a precautionary measure due to a technical issue with the cabin crew oxygen mask. In line with safety procedures, they had to correct it and they diverted it. The flight continued to Dalaman 1 hour and 7 minutes later, and passengers were provided with a complimentary in-flight service while on the ground. This, I guess it wasn't champagne, though. The safety and well-being of our passengers and crew is always EasyJet's highest priority. We would like to apologize for the delays and inconvenience. So there you go. A champagne cork downed an airplane. That's interesting. I love that when I read that. So there's all sorts of ways to down an airplane. Champagne cork, I guess, could be added to the list. All right. Okay, here we go. This is, let me find this one here. There we go. Here we go. This is one. Speaking of planes, and this was another nice segue into this one. If it pulls it up, I'll take a sip of my Cabernet here. All right. Here's why wines taste different when you're on a plane. Wine is increasingly becoming a major priority for flyers, and airlines are investing time and expensive money in sommeliers to create their wine offerings. But it's not as simple as good wine on sea level equals good wine at altitude. Saying that sommeliers need to rethink their methodology in selecting wine for planes. Delta's master sommelier, Andrea Robinson, gave some insight to wines for selection at 30,000 feet. It says, your senses are dulled at altitude, making it difficult to appreciate the complex scents and flavors wine has to offer, she said. In addition, the lower atmospheric pressure versus tasting on land means those flavor molecules are jetting past your sensory receptors so fast, you miss a lot. So, wine on a plane might not be a good idea, spending a lot of money on it. Much like having a cold, the pressurized cabin and its dry air numbs your taste buds and compresses your sense of smell by drying out your nose. Since flavor is a combination of both, in fact, almost 80% of the taste is based on smell, things taste different on a plane. And apparently our sense of salt and sweet can drop by as much as 30% on a plane. Well, that's interesting that they give you unsalted peanuts on a plane. Why don't they just go ahead and give you salted peanuts? A new study also found that loud noise, like that of an airplane, can affect taste as well, making some flavors more intense and dulling others, like sweetness. It's one of the reasons that tomato juice is a flyer favorite. The umami taste of tomatoes is said to be enhanced by the cabin noise. I love it. I really do love it. Wine has a tendency to taste more acidic and tannic at altitude. According to Andre Robinson, strong, gritty tannins don't show as well. Whites with a tart flavor profile also aren't as appealing at altitude as more opulent styles. So this means that the sommeliers must select some fruity wines, low in acid, low in tannins, and good flavors, which, oh my gosh, that is a battle. Robinson says you must navigate the changes altitude and noise can cause on the palate when she selects wines and picks them for the planes. She says she conducts taste tests both on the ground and at altitude to find varietals and blends that perform well. Red wines with bottle age are good at altitude, but the trick is finding the right vintage. Most people enjoy the red Bordeaux with some pedigree, but she looks for Bordeaux back vintages that show more generous fruit, fragrance, and harmony at altitude than the current vintage. Other reliable wines at altitude include Rojo Reserva and Gran Reserva wines. Both are aged and show their age well in altitude. A leathery, mushroomy notes of the Bordeaux, Burgundy, Spanish Rojo, and Rhone varietals are very good. Once a bottle has been identified that works well in altitude, Robinson said, must ensure that she can supply it to Delta with enough bottles. That is no easy feat, considering that Delta served 2.8 million bottles of wine on board in 2014. Oh my gosh, 2.8 million bottles of wine on board. A safe bet, stick to the Bloody Marys. Interesting little article. I enjoyed that when I first read it. 2.8 million bottles. So, this is something I've always told people and I've always said, and this is something that I think has been proven. But this article is, women are better tasters than men. And a few years ago, National Geographic magazine ran an article, a test, if you will, for smell. And since smell is like 80% of what you're tasting, like we just read in the last article, if not more, it was found that they had little scratch and sniff things there, and you scratch and sniff it, and then you fill out the little questionnaire, and you drop it in an envelope and send it to them. And they got, thousands and thousands of replies, tens of thousands of replies of people taking this test and all that. And they concluded that women overall are much better at distinguishing smells than men are, which, okay, yeah, I always tell people, you walk home after being out for a while, you walk in the door, and your wife goes, "Oh my God, what's that smell?" And you go, "I don't know, I don't smell anything." So, women are good at smelling stuff, which would lead to the conclusion that they're probably better at tasting things. But this article says they are. It says genetics certainly have something to do with the way we have different perceptions of taste. There's a genetic component to how we experience bitter and sweet flavors, and super tasters who seem to be born rather than made are said to experience a lot of taste more intensely. But the nuances of flavors, they're saying it's as simple as gender. Dr. Douglas Constantiner said that a food and beer pairing event, Washington, hosted by the Brewers Association, Dr. Constantiner is a co-founder of Sosite Brewing Company, was sipping Sosite's IPA, the Pupil, when someone mentioned genetic predisposition and taste that prompted him to boldly state, and I quote, "Women are predisposed to have a better sense of taste and smell than men." And the writer of this article says he turned around with his glass an inch from his nose and going, "What?" And the doctor said, "Yes, science says so. I see that women need a lot less training to get to the same level of tasting as men. Like my wife and co-founder Travis Smith's wife, they can pick up stuff naturally. And after training for a long time, men will get to the one point where women will do it very easily." Researchers have tried to get at gender differences in the sense of smell, which, again, is implication of sense of taste. A lot of our experience is through our nose, is something I emphasize to the class I teach. Back in 2002, doctors at Rutgers University got interested in the phenomenon of how some individuals can become increasingly sensitive to certain odors over time. detecting them at lower and lower concentrations. Earlier studies suggested that this is a gender phenomenon. So they wanted to find out. So they trained a group of men and women at various ages to identify two specific odors. The researchers then had both the men and women smell the odors in increasingly diluted concentrations. And they found something quite interesting. As they reported in the paper that was published in 2002, the Nature Neuroscience, the women who were of reproductive age saw their sensitivity to one of the odors increase by an average of 5 orders of magnitude. Wow, crazy. It was such a bizarre observation. They thought it was so bizarre that they decided to duplicate the test to find out. In the second study, which appeared in the Chemical Senses in 2005, the researchers ran more experiments. They trained men and women to detect more odors, and they tested postmenopausal women and age-matched men, as well as prepubescent boys and girls. And again, they found that only women of reproductive age were able to detect multiple odors at increasingly lower concentrations over time. What gives? This time, women of reproductive age could, with some training, identify odors at concentrations up to 11 orders of magnitude lower than men who had started out with similar experience with the smell. 11 orders of magnitude is huge. Breslin says sex hormones present in reproductive women must have something to do with it. It's not the women that women are super sensitive to anything. It's just that the women are a little better when they focus their attention on smell. The findings may help explain why women are more likely than men to develop chemical intolerance syndromes. When you notice and become irritated by odors present at very low levels. And it's also might, they have, why is this so much higher level in reproductive age women? And only guesses, maybe it's because they have to detect things to protect their offspring and stuff like that. They don't know. They have done tests, and they found that women might have a greater need to be able to recognize and bond with their kin through smell. It has been shown that mothers can pick out their baby's smell from a big group. So, maybe that's it. That said, the Florida Center for Smell and Taste, Linda Bartoshuk, has found that super tasting abilities are more common in women than in men. And she said, it's hard to come up with a good estimate, but in one study of 4,000 Americans, she found that 34% of them, that's huge, really, were super-tasting women. By comparison, super-tasting men were 22% of the study. So it's, when they ask what the difference is, they really... had a divisive answer. The women pick it up faster, learn it faster, then ultimately they have faster sensory recollection, and that gives them more confidence, especially in blind tastings. There you go. It goes on to point out other things in wines and stuff that women have been able to pick up at very low levels, like Brett, yeast that can ruin the wine. Women can pick that up immediately, if they know what it is, they immediately can detect that a wine has Brett. They also feel confident about their acquired skills, and explains why 20% of sommeliers today are women, but the atmosphere is changing. The traditionally the sommeliers were very male dominated. And now it's becoming more and more women because they're able to show their abilities of picking up smells and things that once they get trained for them, they can find them immediately. And It says, which also explains this writer here says why I, a reproductive age woman, couldn't taste the mango and guava in a beer. I simply haven't trained enough. So there you go. Women can do much better in smell and hence taste than men can. So, and I've known that for a long time. That's been proven, you know, over the centuries and all that. This is a little bit more comprehensive study toward wine, but it's always a good thing. Let me go back a couple of quick things I want to talk to you about here, too. I thought that was a very interesting article when I first read that women's ability to be able to pick up. Let's see. Nope, that's not it. Okay, it's just taking us time here. All right. Here it does. Complained about my computer so many times, I don't need to complain anymore. Let's see. Hail Hit Chablis on Wine Harvest Eve, which is not good. I mean, throughout the year, trying to pick and all that. They're saying that it they survived well, and it's not going to be a big problem, but it did reduce some of the crop. So there's a problem with that. And let's see. Wildfire smoke taint. We've talked about this a lot, and the fire is still going crazy out there east of Napa. Although the wind's coming off the water and blowing east, and I think the smoke is pretty good away from Napa, but we're always hearing about this. I have people come in all the time talking about, oh, I have a friend there, I have a son that lives in Napa and all that, and most people who live in Napa don't really live in Napa, but they're out in that area there, and they're saying that they can smell smoke all the time. But yeah, you can. Here in Florida, we've had our wildfires in the past, and we'll smell smoke, and we'll look at maps, and the only smoke would be on the other side of the state, which is, you know, 3 hours away. And you're going, well, you know, but so it's just, as they're saying, the wildfires up through Napa and into Oregon, Washington, is bad, but so far the wine should be unaffected, the grapes should be unaffected, and there should not be a problem. There was a vineyard that was destroyed by fire, though. I don't know if you heard about that. That happened this past week. A vineyard was really just the big fires that were working their way up there in the northern part of the state, and it just burned it up, wiped it out completely. And let's see, I got one other thing to tell you about here. There's and then we'll close out the program tonight. A new wine movie. We all know the movie's out. oh my gosh, I got a blank now. Sideways, that's one I think of, and the other one with the tastings and all that. Well, there's a new wine movie out. Somm. It's Into the Bottle. It's coming this year. It's a review. The screenwriter and director is Jason Wise. And it's a sequel to Somm, which he captured the intensity of a master sommelier training and exam program. Irene King, if you're listening to me here, this might be a movie you'd be interested in, too. Somm opened in Napa back in 2012, but this time they broadened his sights to include how wine is made. He touches on this journey from the field to your table and also includes some wine history. Somm is scheduled to run in Napa from 11th to the 15th of November, And then it's featured in the Napa Valley Film Festival. And so it'll be one of 125 independent films showing up there. So if you're in the area or something to look forward to, Psalm, the first one, this is Psalm Into the Bottles. This is coming out in November, and it is the big journey of the grape to the table. And let's see, I had something else I want to tell you here, too. Before I go, the origin of wine grapes. This is a little quick thing here I'm going to go through with you and tell you about. The origin of wine grapes. This is from the Daily Sip. Dated almost a month ago. Wow. It says, where were the world's first wine grapes growing? We know the names of famous wine appellations today, but where was the world's first wine appellation? Grape geneticist Dr. Jose Vula Moss and biomolecular archaeologist Dr. Patrick McGovern think they might know. Their research, which was published last fall, revealed that most of the wine grapes cultivated today come from the southern region of Turkey, and that farmers there grew grapevines to make wine as long ago as 8,000 BC and possibly before. Vulamos and McGovern discovered the origins of domesticated grapevines by using DNA sequencing, which revealed that the greatest number of matches between the DNA in domestic wine grape varieties and the DNA in wild varieties occurred in southern Turkey. This DNA sequencing also provided insight into surprising family connections, because some of our favorite wine grapes varieties, like Syrah, is the great-great-grandchild of Pinot Noir and Gouache Blanc. G-O-U-A-I-S, Gouache, I guess, Gouache. Known to make only a neutral quaffing wine, it is the surprising Casanova wine grapes. The Gouache Blanc, fathering more than 80 other grape varieties, including some popular ones like Chardonnay, Riesling, and Gamay. Look it up. It's an interesting little grape. I won't go into it with you here, but you can look it up. G-O-U-A-I-S. Blanc. B-L-A-N-C. The wine elite may flock to Bordeaux and Napa Valley today, but Turkey was where it was at during the Stone Age. So, interesting. It's very interesting little article. Turkey was the center of the wine industry of the world. We're done for the night. Thank you for tuning in. I always appreciate you listening. If you have any questions, have any comments, have anything, by all means, get in touch with me. You can get in touch with me through Facebook. You can get in touch with me on the email. Also call the winery or get in touch with us through the winery website, floridastateswines.com. And I will be happy to talk with you or answer your questions or find out something for you. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week. As always, we enjoy you spending your time with us and hope you learned something. Hope you had a good time. And we'll have yourself a wonderful week. What do we got coming up this week here? We have anything interesting? POWMIA Day is tomorrow. And then, of course, the 23rd, next Wednesday, before we get on, is Yom Kippur begins, as is the first day of autumn. So we're into the cooler weather here in Florida. We're going to have to get out our socks to wear with our flip-flops. So look forward to seeing you all next week. Have yourself a wonderful week. Drink lots of wine, and we'll see you next week.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine.
with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida States Winery. Florida States Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 or east of US 19 and US 41. For more information on Florida States Winery, visit the website at floridaestateswines.com or call area code 813-996-2113. The email address is corp@floon.com. That's corp@floon.com. For more information on All About Wine and future shows, please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr or visit our website at allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available as a free download on iTunes and on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on All About Wine.